Terrific. Susan, it's great to have this interview with you this afternoon. So, you know, I have a law degree, and I practiced law for about 10 minutes before I went into sort of what I call public action and advocacy, and represented and supported senior citizens, and that led me to a 17-year career in state government, 14 years for three different governors, leading the Department on Aging, and then 3 years as the Secretary of Health. I'm also a small business owner that specializes in getting insurance and healthcare access to people who are not insured and making sure it's affordable and accessible. And I'm a county commissioner, but the most important things is I'm a mom of two incredible daughters and a caregiver for my wonderful mother.
Okay. How are you able to work with all those different governors? Is it because you were just kind of in the corner and they didn't notice you?
Oh, I would say that no one in my entire career said I wasn't noticed. I might be small, but I got a loud voice. You know, I'll tell you, it was constituents. I never lost sight of who it was that I worked for. And in fact, I would sort of disclose that to the governors who appointed me. You know, I certainly have to deliver and execute plans on your behalf and through this administration. But I work for senior citizens and their families, and I don't care what their political affiliation is, and I don't care what their voting records are, and I don't care how active they are. I care about getting their issues addressed, and if they're happy, of course, people feel like the government's responsive. So that's always good for a governor and for legislators. So elected officials, I think, really found more often than not that I was really easy to work with because I always focused on the constituents, and I didn't get lost in all the other noise.
One of the agencies you worked for was the Agency on Aging, it was called then. And obviously that's a woman's issue, but let's talk about what you've worked on as women's issues.
Well, I appreciate you taking a step back so I can move forward. Absolutely. You know, I was looking at how issues affect women early at the Department on Aging or the State Agency on Aging, if you will. And I think people forget about women live longer. And so their health care issues and their independence issues and their financial security issues in that population, really significant issues. Two, survivor benefits. You know, your income, not only are you living longer and having to figure out how to navigate that on a finite income, you get your survivor benefits are really poor. And in that generation, think how many women weren't in the workforce. So they had no other income of their own, and they didn't have comprehensive health care. And they were raising their grandchildren on $700 or $800 a month and trying to keep a roof over their heads. So I really got immersed in some of the most difficult issues affecting women and stability. And I took that with me to the Department of Health, where now we have a myriad of comprehensive health care issues for women, making sure that we protected access to reproductive justice services, including family planning and birth control. We had four different waivers, three that were administered by the Department of Health. And for the public, that means taking federal and state dollars that were reserved to provide health care or long-term care services for disabled or very sick children becomes absolutely a woman's issue because they're waiting to have access to those services. And some of these women were caring for aging parents and, you know, more than one, several disabled children in their families. It was really tough going.
When you were at the Department of Health, one of your headaches was the long-term care nursing homes. And I sort of remember that you closed them or you had to do some, you had to sort of make some decisions and step out there.
You know, I did. I did that my whole career, and I think we're going to hear about that more in this campaign. You know, there wasn't a day that went by when I was at Aging that I didn't get a complaint about someone's care in a nursing home, either from the individual who lived there or from their family members. And the Department of Health has licensing or oversight responsibility, and I couldn't do anything about it from Aging, and I couldn't get anyone's attention. So I trained undercover as a direct care worker, and then I went undercover in a nursing home as a stroke victim. victim. And that really set, I did, and that set the stage for turning the Department of Health over on its head. And in the Johnson administration, we changed the face of regulatory oversight for nursing homes. It became one of the strongest states in the country for holding them accountable, including taking over their finances, requiring criminal background checks, which we weren't doing before, for caregivers, not only in nursing homes but in hospitals, putting in monitors, posting who was staffing, how to find them, requiring minimum staffing, requiring new standards for administering health care and prescription drugs. We were very strong. But there still, you know, lies two problems. One, nursing homes are tough environments, and there are risks involved that I think are untenable, but they're there. And two, notoriously so, state government all across the United States usually doesn't do the same kind of quality job. I just have to say, maybe it's because they get underfunded. Maybe it's because they're put in communities where they're hidden away. And I was very concerned about the Department of Health and how it was running its facilities, and I was asked to clean it up. And I was, you know, if you're going to complain about those issues, you better be willing to stand there and do something about it. And so I did. And in taking responsibility, recognized that Fort Baird was one of the worst facilities probably in the state at the time. And we brought in a federal investigative team, the Department of Justice, and held public meetings and fired the staff and brought in a whole new staff. And during that environment, we recognized, as we did in-depth investigations, that the care was really a disaster, so much so that I decided the best way to finish cleaning it up was for me to get my nursing home administrator's license, and I did. And I moved to Silver City, and I took it over myself. And we improved the care. We had no more findings. The Department of Justice commended me for my work. We built a $48 million facility, and during that time, I closed several Borden Cares. I closed a nursing home in Roswell, or Clovis. I think it was Clovis, now that I think about it. We were closing facilities here in Albuquerque, and for the first time ever, we were prosecuting administrators. And so we have a zero tolerance for abuse, neglect, and exploitation, and probably the best compliment I ever got from a private nursing home administrator is, she's tough, but you know what? She's holding public and private sector operators responsible in the same way and accountable, and no one's ever done that before.
Wow. What do you think about the state of the nursing homes in New Mexico now?
I'm concerned. I'm concerned that we have continued to lower reimbursement rates, which means lower standards. I'm worried that we haven't been recruiting sufficient volunteers to sort of be the eyes and the ears for the individuals who live there who don't have family members. I've never been a big fan that taking 200 individuals who are really sick and frail and putting you all together in this kind of a care environment, I don't think it's very productive. I think that they're very risky, and I'm concerned. I do think that we've seen a growth in smaller assisted living or boarding care homes, and I think that those are an opportunity to do a better job. And I encourage family members and individuals that if you have any issues to reach out and call the state's ombudsman program, and there are posters. That's another requirement that we passed during those Johnson years, that you have a complaint poster in every room, every hall, and every major area of every licensed long-term care facility in the state.
Okay, good. I wonder whether, let's get back to talking about running for Congress.
Oh, I love it.
I wonder whether this is the time to do it, because do you really want to go there when the Republicans are in control, at least right now, and it seems so acrimonious?
You know, what a perfect segue. Nobody wanted to take on the tough issues in state government, and so they would ask me, you're going to identify that it's a problem. Are you willing to step into the problem and fix it? I'm willing to step into this problem and do something about it. And I think it takes a person, I think it takes this woman, this candidate, who recognizes that I might not be able to get everybody in Congress to want to work together overnight. But you can create a dynamic where that becomes what is required and expected. And while you do that, while you're reaching across the aisle and you're building a consensus, you're creating an environment where more people than not want to work together, you can deliver services and better end results to your constituents right back here at home. And so it's the lessons that I learned in state government and in business. It's the lessons that I continue to see and learn and respond to as a county commissioner. Be in touch with those families, help them with jobs and education and health care and long-term care. Be part of a change agent in your state. Work with the legislators and all bodies of local government. Work with Sandia Labs to get jobs moving, high-tech careers and brand new companies started right here. Work with UNM and other partners to change how we're doing public education in spite of Congress. And you know what? Pretty soon you have a whole body of advocates. So I'm not alone representing New Mexico in Congress. I've got 700,000 best friends, and we are all working in Congress, and that is a very powerful dynamic.
Well, tell me what's happening with your campaign and how you're being received. Who's endorsing it? What's happening?
Well, I think we've got real momentum. We just got endorsed by the Albuquerque Journal. We got endorsed by the Alibi, and I'm unabashed. I am really proud of those endorsements. They are tough to get, particularly sort of two newspapers that are identified as having very different perspectives about what they're looking for in a candidate. But both the Alibi and the Journal said, here's someone who's clear about her values, who's clear about what she wants to achieve, and knows that in order to achieve it, she's got to get more than just her vote lined up. You got to get Democrats lined up. You're going to have to get Republicans lined up. You're going to have to get sort of a sea change of interest. I have to deal with apathy here on the ground. We all have to be passionate about making it right. And they both believe that not only do I have a track record that indicates that I've gotten that done before, but I have a pathway to getting it done again.
Okay.
And then on a national level, we've got Emily's List, which is a renowned advocacy and PAC, or a political action committee designed to support women to be elected to these kinds of offices, and a group called Poder, which also supports Hispanic female candidates, and the Women's Campaign Fund, and some more folks locally here on the ground. Acoma Pueblo just announced their full endorsement, and probably people don't know is that I've got a growing group in the healthcare and paraprofessional healthcare community. So we've received financial support from the emergency room physicians and from the Physical Therapy Association. And it's those groups that have to be part of the solutions in healthcare. And so I'm really delighted with the momentum that we have, and we're feeling strong, but recognize that this is still a very competitive race.
Okay. How about money? Have you been able to raise money? That's what people always look at women candidates to see whether they can raise money.
I have. In fact, I got in September, the other candidates May, June, so I had some catching up to do. And at the end of the very last reporting cycle, which was the end of March, I not only raised about as much total money as the other two candidates and the lead fundraiser, Eric Griego. In that regard, since May, I have more cash on hand. So the tests about whether or not you're financially viable, I was leading in December, I was leading in March, and we believe that we're leading right up to the finish. And the majority of our resources are coming from right here in this community. Okay. What's wonderful about talking to these candidates is I'm thrilled to be in a position to get to run. I'm ready to change that dynamic. I do think that qualified, quality women can really be the effective dynamic that changes the way in which Congress operates and the way in which our national policymaking gets done. And with health care and women's rights and civil rights being paramount about what we do to further those protections or at least hang on to the ones that we have, I really think that these become leadership issues for women in particular. And I am so proud to be in a position to, be more than an ally or a reliable vote, but be the woman who carries that torch for my daughters and for our granddaughters, and really to all the men who are going to listen to this, to support our partners, to make sure that we create the right kind of family foundations that are meaningful in this country. And so we're going to win this race. I'm very honored to be able to get to do that, and it's been a really fantastic experience thus far.
Okay, good. Thank you.